Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. Several years ago on this program, we heard from Executive Director Gary Smith about the history of the American Academy in Berlin, and from Dean of Fellows Pamela Rosenberg about the selection process for the dozen or so fellows who are with us in residence at the American Academy for a semester.
They apply, and they are chosen on the strength of the project that they are proposing to work on while they're here. There is a committee based in the U.S., mainly made up of professors from distinguished universities. There is, in addition to that, though, an extra committee to choose the composer and an extra committee to choose the visual artist.
That's how our Academy Fellows get here. But what happens after they arrive? What are the benefits to being in Berlin? We asked two of this semester's fellows.
My name is James Brophy, and I'm a professor of history at the University of Delaware. And I applied for a fellowship at the American Academy in Berlin to be close to my materials. My project focuses on Central European publishers, German publishers, and their relationship to authors, their relationship to print markets, and I'm interested in figuring out the print circuits of Germany and how they entangled themselves, how they connected with Western Europe and North America. So the Academy seemed like a perfect place to do this work. It's an institution that's dedicated to a transatlantic dialogue, and in some ways I'm doing a history that's exactly that. I'm trying to figure out to what extent the age of democratic revolution, or what they call the Atlantic Age, the degree to which Germany participated in that. So rather than talking about discourse or talking about, you know, intellectual impulses and other abstract ideas, I'm trying to look at the publication lists. I'm trying to look at the publishers and the bookshops and the book commissioners that transacted this exchange of ideas. It's a very sort of concrete social historical portrait of print.
James Brophy sees those early distribution and business patterns as a sort of 18th or 19th century internet. That is to say, how information was spread across nations and continents in that early era.
It's a new approach. It looks at publishers not so much as the history of one house or the history of one person, but looking at them as a social collectivity, as a social group, and their role as cultural brokers, their role as political actors, and to see them as an important force in the beginnings of political modernity. This period runs from roughly 1770 to the 1870s, 1880s, from the period of the late Enlightenment, if you will, or the late absolutism, a few decades before the French Revolution, into the age of revolutions and into the age of nation building up through the 1870s. And this was a century or two or three generations of a new kind of publisher that speculated and was interested in taking advantage of free markets. Books can make money. And part of the book is entitled The Markets of Knowledge. And I'm trying to look at this relationship between political and cultural convictions along with making money, the business of print, and combining profit with principles, and to see this relationship between publishers and how they created their authors and how they promoted certain kinds of genres, whether it be literature, reportage, drama, poetry, newspapers, starting newspapers, challenging political authority with magazines and newspapers, this kind of thing. It was risky. You could lose money, but you could make money. A lot of my printers did time in jail, anywhere from 2 to 6 to 8 weeks to sometimes 8 years for selling forbidden books. It's a risky enterprise in Central Europe to be a politically engaged publisher. And for that reason, the story is all the more interesting. There's about 850 publishers in the 1830s, 1840s. My database has about 120 of them. Because these publishing houses didn't survive the 19th century, the companies that bought them out usually destroyed their company papers. So that's what makes historians cry, is to see all this good material be destroyed. But yes, we have found there are letters, and there are very, very good materials to unearth this story, to reconstruct this story. And it's really so important to get the reaction of German scholars, to hear how they receive it. And so before I publish this book, it's just wonderful to have the opportunity to have a first go with the experts in Central Europe and to hear their criticisms, their enthusiasms, their questions. So many times in scholarship, it's always a question of misrecognition. It's like what they hear. Sometimes you realize that you're not pitching it in the correct way, that you're not framing the problem, the issues in a way where you can successfully convey what you want to convey. So it's enormously beneficial. It's enormously valuable, as any scholar knows.
My name is Tara Zara. I teach history at the University of Chicago, and I came to be at the Academy because I had heard from many colleagues that it's a wonderful place to be. They said that in some cases that, you know, they'd never been treated so well. They talked about the fantastic librarian who's famous all over the academic world, I think. They talked about the wonderful food, and they talked about the chance to meet and talk to a lot of really fascinating people, both the other fellows at the Academy and people in Berlin that they met while they were here. I didn't really know what to expect. It's a little like moving into your freshman dorm coming here, because it's an unusual experience to be living and working in one place with a group of other scholars once you've left college. And you wonder, you know, will you get along? Will you like the other people? But it's been a fantastic group, and I've learned a lot from getting to talk to fiction writers and architectural historians and artists and political scientists, as well as other historians. And I've had a really great time traveling around Germany, getting a chance to meet colleagues in my field at other universities outside Berlin and in Berlin. I'm working on a book about emigration from East Central Europe to the West, going back to the late 19th century and continuing into the Cold War era, maybe to the present. I haven't quite decided, but the theme of the book is really looking at how debates about emigration, millions of people leaving their home over the course of this century, were linked to changing ideas about freedom and slavery and free labor. I'm also trying to show how the restrictions on mobility that we associate with the Cold War, the Iron Curtain, actually have roots well back into the 19th century when people started getting concerned about immigration. It's exciting to be here because the issue of mobility in the Cold War is probably not more alive or relevant anywhere in the world, maybe, more than in Berlin, which was where the Berlin Wall was the symbol of immobility and the captivity of millions of people for 50 years. So it's a place where I feel like even non-historians are familiar with the kinds of themes I'm talking about and interested in talking to me about them.
University of Chicago historian Tara Zara. Earlier, we heard from the University of Delaware's James Brophy. Both are fellows living and working at the American Academy in Berlin this fall. After this brief break, we'll be back with a perspective from Berlin on the current rift in U.S.-German relations. You're listening to the Berlin Journal from NPR Berlin.
Think about the birth of an idea and all the possibilities it presents.
The big idea here.
Whatever brilliant ideas
to believe
you have
in
or
the true nature of reality
is the gift of the human imagination.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for an audio journey through the big ideas of our time. Ideas that will change your view of the world on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The fallout from the National Security Agency leaks continues to spread. Over the weekend, Germany's leading newspapers lashed out at President Obama, once a beloved figure in Europe. "Obama's aura is gone," read one headline. The outrage comes from reports that the Obama administration knew the U.S. government was monitoring the personal phone calls of German Chancellor Angela Merkel for more than a decade. This comes after earlier leaks alleging that the NSA was listening in on...
In recent weeks, news media in both the U.S. and Germany have devoted a great deal of attention to the revelation that the U.S. National Security Administration, the NSA, has been hacking into private cell phone conversations of German Chancellor Angela Merkel for years. In the U.S., The revelations about the eavesdropping on the German chancellor come amidst a number of other disclosures about spying on foreign leaders who are also American allies. But in Germany, sensitivity about wiretapping carries an even more sinister meaning. Chancellor Merkel was born and raised in communist East Germany, one of the most Orwellian surveillance states in history. The East German government spied on nearly everyone, wiretapped communications, bugged private homes, and paid a large cadre of informers, including family members, all in an effort to stamp out political dissent. Fear and suspicion were an integral part of everyday life. Andrew Nathan, a professor of political science at Columbia University and a fellow at the Academy this fall, is one of America's leading authorities on Chinese politics and on global efforts to strengthen international human rights norms. Producer Jeff Rosenberg sat down with Andrew Nathan to talk about the question of privacy as a human right and how his vantage point here in Berlin this semester has altered his view of the recent worldwide revelations about the nature and extent of government espionage.
Well, people here have really been scandalized. Some have said it may even threaten the alliance, and others have said that the Germans should hold off negotiating a free trade agreement with the United States that's on the table. And I think the reason that it's such a big issue in Germany is the history here of dictatorship. They've lived through two of them. First, the Nazi dictatorship, and then the East German dictatorship. And both of them were very intrusive, but in particular, the East German dictatorship had a huge secret police operation that did a great deal of electronic eavesdropping under the technology of that time, a little bit primitive by our standards, but putting taps on people's phones and bugs in people's walls and paying attention to absolutely everything, people's private lives and so on. And the Germans have really, you know, are past that and really want a liberal society that respects people's privacy. And this is not only Germany. The Europeans have a human rights convention called the European Convention on Human Rights, and they have a human rights court. And the Court of Human Rights has gradually developed a set of judgments on what they call the right to privacy. It's a right that we don't actually have in the United States, but Europeans view the right to privacy as a human right. And then I think a third issue is the trust between Merkel. So there's one thing about spying on citizens, that's the right to privacy, but spying on Merkel in particular, who's a very loyal ally and a straight talker, you know, whom you can trust, and to the idea that you can't trust her and you have to spy on her to find out what she thinks, that strikes people as quite offensive because you can call her up and ask her what she thinks and she'll tell you.
A little earlier, you said to me you hoped the Germans were effective themselves at monitoring what was going on in their population.
Of course, I don't have access to any secret information, but I guess it's probably safe to say that the U.S. technology of spying on the internet and phone calls and social media is more advanced, and the amount of investment that we put into it is larger than any other country. But I would think that every country in the world is doing the analogous thing to the level that they're capable of doing. And in Germany, I would expect that their intelligence agencies are keeping a pretty close eye on something analogous to what the NSA. I don't mean spying on Merkel, but I mean spying on communications in the mass population to try to locate nodes of activity that would tip them off to something dangerous. And the reason I say that is, number one, Germany is a big crossroads in Europe for people coming and going from the Middle East, from North Africa, from Central Asia. Most of the 9/11 terrorists actually came from Germany to the United States. So if I were a German public security official, I'd be, you know, looking at all of these populations moving through my country, and I'd be worried about a terrorist attack right here in Germany, which could be a spectacular thing. This is the leading economy in Europe and so forth. And that terrorist attack in Germany has not taken place. And presumably one of the reasons it hasn't taken place is that the German security agencies are doing a pretty good job.
A few decades ago, Germany went through its own experience with domestic terrorism. Can you remind us a little about that?
Well, let me say this, first of all. Today, when you're in Germany, it's a strikingly stable kind of boring society in a good way. You know, we feel extremely safe. And the political scene is not very polarized. The several political parties are all really pretty close to one another, and they enter into coalitions with one another. But in the late 60s and early 70s, Germany was a very, very different place. There was an intense polarization with a very strong sort of leftist student movement and anti-colonialism movement, and they were accusing the governing party of really being a kind of rebirth of Nazism, which really wasn't true, but it was a conservative party. And the extreme wing of this sort of student slash youth movement convinced themselves that they needed to use violence to get the intent to sort of shake up society. And there was one gang in particular that was very, very famous called the Bader-Meinhof gang, which conducted some terrorist incidents, and those people were finally caught and imprisoned. The point is here that, you know, Germany has been through homegrown terrorist incidents. Most of the people are too young to really remember it, but they know the history of it.
Would you say that colors their outlook on external terrorism?
That's logical, but I don't know whether, I haven't seen that connection drawn. I think even without a history, and we ourselves in the United States have our own history of domestic terrorism, people like Timothy McVeigh, we've had that too. But I guess that probably in both the U.S. and in Germany, foreign terrorism is sort of seen in a different category and perhaps even viewed as more scary in a way. Certainly nothing in either Germany or the United States has ever approached the scale of 9/11. I mean, that was unique. In the German response to the NSA spying scandal, there's a substratum, which is that many Germans view American foreign policy as kind of dangerous and aggressive. They're not the only ones in the world who take that view, but perhaps the Germans are especially sensitive to that view. So Germany, of course, started two world wars. They invaded their neighbors and so on. And the Germans today are extremely conscious of that history and have really sworn never again. And so their foreign policy approach is really, really careful and respectful, not to even, you know, rhetorically push around their neighbors or tell anybody else what to do, which is one of the reasons why Germany's human rights foreign policy is, in my opinion, weaker than it ought to be. But they feel, who are we to tell anybody else, much less to send troops anyplace? And they sent troops to Afghanistan. That was extremely rare, which they did under great pressure from the United States. But they see the U.S. practice of deploying its troops all over the world and invading this, that, and the other country on the grounds of humanitarian reasons and then changing the regime there. I mean, this is how they see how we have behaved, for example, in Libya, where they refused to get involved in helping the humanitarian mission because they feel it's a mistake to use force so much. Even though bad things may happen, you can't just solve everything by using force. Using force is worse, in a way, from their point of view. So I think they hook the NSA spying scandal into that picture of the United States that is, you know, too big, too aggressive, and they can't go along with that. Now, of course, it's complicated and it's ambivalent because certainly Germany benefits and cooperates, as far as I know, with U.S. intelligence operations because we all have a common interest in preventing terrorism. But it's a question of how out of control, in their view, these things are.
this seems more like a post-Cold War direction that Germany is going sort of off at an angle from the United States. And some commentators in the U.S. worry that this is the end of the great American alliance, the American-led alliance that kept the world safe, prevented World War III from happening. And now it seems to be like cats wandering off in many directions.
That may idealize the smoothness of German-U.S. cooperation before the end of the Cold War, because then, too, Germany had its own problem, which was the division of Germany, and had its own policy, which was to get along with East Germany and accept the, it's sort of paradoxical, but to accept the permanent existence of East Germany as a way to a very, very long-term strategy of hoping for the reunification of Germany. So the Germans had their own foreign policy during the Cold War as well, and they were not just tight allies of the United States to do everything that we wanted to do, like confronting the Soviet Union. But it is true that today as well, Germany has its own foreign policy interests and priorities. There are many places in the world where the U.S. has important security interests, I mean military interests, such as Asia, where Germany has no military interests at all. And Germany doesn't feel any security threat from Russia. It actually doesn't feel any real security threat from any place. The biggest, closest thing that Germany has to a security threat is really refugees from the Arab world and North Africa.
Columbia University professor Andrew Nathan. He's a fellow at the American Academy this semester, currently examining the future of the international rights regime and the main actors shaping it, the U.S., Europe, and China. Nathan is the author of the recent book, China's Search for Security. When we come back from a brief break, we'll delve into the life and work of the legendary father of modern architecture, Mies van der Rohe. You're listening to the Berlin Journal from NPR Berlin.
Hi, this is Bob Boylan, host of NPR's All Songs Considered. Here at NPR Music, it's our job to bring you new music and exclusive footage. I'm usually here hard at work, but ever so often, I give up my desk to let musicians do the job. Bands play short sets at my desk, usually two or three songs, and you can get the front row seats at nprmusic.org.
Oh, man. I'm not gonna lie, I'm pretty nervous.
I am for discipline. I am for clarity, for good craftsmanship, even if it is done in a steel mill.
The gravelly voice and thick German-accented English are unmistakable to serious students of modern architecture. They belong to Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, the Bauhaus icon who first startled the world with his spare, elegant pavilion for the 1929 International Exposition in Barcelona, and led what has come to be considered the vanguard of modern architecture. The graceful Barcelona chairs he designed for the building still sell today by the thousands each year. Mies came to Chicago in 1938 to teach at what is now the Illinois Institute of Technology, and his American architectural work developed the concept and look of the American skyscraper, including the iconic Seagram Building on Park Avenue in New York City. Brown University architectural historian Dietrich Neumann has been researching the early works of Mies in Berlin, as well as one of his late masterpieces, the Neue Nationalgalerie, built in 1968 in what was then West Berlin's Kulturforum. We invited a Berlin-based architectural historian and former student of Neumann's, Robin Schuldenfrei of Humboldt University, to sit down with Dietrich Neumann and talk about his nearly completed critical biography of Mies, which he's working on this semester at the Academy.
You know, there are obviously a number of biographies already that have been written about Mies, actually quite a number of them. And so what I'm trying to do is to contextualize him more than he has been contextualized before. I really believe that one can only understand an architect's work if you look at what everybody else was doing at the time, what the debates were, the politics behind it, who the clients were, what he understood of construction, what was new, what did he adopt from others. So it's trying to be very rich in context. and hopefully that will provide some new perspectives on his work.
Mm. So what have you discovered?
Well, I think it seems to me he was less of a solitaire than people always thought and made him out to be. In the books about him so far, it always looks as if he's mostly looking at his own work and developing it further step by step. So these biographies often look like a series of masterpieces that are being presented to us. And I think in each case, one can show how he actually reacted to his environment, to his colleagues, where he took some ideas. Actually, he was accused of plagiarism a few times because he took somebody else's idea. But what is interesting to me is then to see what did he do with those ideas. And often he sharpened them, he made them more radical, more stringent, more logical, and often visually more beautiful. But to understand that, it's very important to see what did he take from other famous Berlin architects at the time, who often had much more work. Let's say Eric Mendelssohn, the Luckart brothers, the Touts. He knew them all, and he looked at their work and often, you know, was inspired by what they did and then developed it further.
And what about the fabric, the urban fabric, the city fabric of Berlin itself? How did that influence Mies? Obviously, he's coming from a smaller city to a major metropolis in that period. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience would have been like for him as a person, as an architect?
I imagine it must have been really exciting to come from Aachen, where he was born, into this thriving metropolis. He arrived in Berlin in 1905, and there was a lot going on. There were enormous buildings going up, great department stores, and already with enormous glass facades. The subway was being built, and those elevated trains that we all love so much, you know. Grenander was here, the great Swedish architect who did a lot of the design for it, and new storefronts were being built. I think that must have been absolutely exhilarating. It seems to me that there are two things going on. I see on a small level that he really adopts a lot of the new materials and ideas that show up in Berlin's very thriving commercial architecture. I'm thinking of enormous window panes in his residential architecture of the 1920s. Let's say at the Barcelona Pavilion, which is somewhat residential in its concept, and of course the Villa Tugendhat. These enormous window panes that he used, that of course come from display windows that he had seen on Kurfürstendamm or elsewhere. Materials such as chromium that he uses for the first time in a domestic setting, designing furniture that is chrome covered, very exciting stuff. Of course, that was used in commercial architecture before. Or opal glass, as they called it, which is sort of a translucent, milky white glass that was very common in commercial design in Berlin in the 1920s. In fact, I found a quote where the New York Times says, Berlin is the world capital of opal glass because they loved using it in facades of buildings and so on. And he uses it in a domestic setting, very exciting. I think these sort of transitions from one area to another, that's sort of one of his strategies. It's sort of, I think it aims a little bit at shock value too, to have a home that suddenly has enormous glass and chrome and things like that. Lighting, of course, backlighting. Lots of these elements come in. He witnessed, when he came to Berlin, an enormous period of change. So Mies sees this city in constant change and upheaval, and things don't last very long. Buildings come down very quickly again in areas in the center. And so I feel that might have influenced him in such a way that most of his designs are really solitaire buildings that have very little connection to the immediate environment. So if you look at his later work or even his earlier glass skyscrapers, they're meant really in contrast to what is there and not really in response to it. So if you think of his early designs of shining glass skyscrapers, they are drawn in front or in the middle of sort of dark historicist architecture. They could be almost in any big city. It's really about this difference and the contrast. And I think the buildings he builds later in Chicago or in New York, they're also solitaires, and he didn't change them much. If he would still apply the same types in Chicago and Montreal and Baltimore. And
do you think on that note that these buildings are then, from his perspective, meant to be icons, to be monuments, architecture capital A?
That's a very good question. My feeling was always that he did not mind replicating a solution that he had found once. He actually famously said, I don't need to reinvent architecture every Monday morning. That was, of course, you know, a little stab at colleagues who were trying to constantly be innovative and picturesque in many ways. So I think he imagined that once he had found a good solution for a skyscraper, that was what he was going to give his clients many times over. And that's, in the end, what they expected from him too, right? So I don't necessarily think that he intended them as monuments, but of course some of them became monuments. I'm thinking in particular of the Seagram Building, which was celebrated by the clients, the Bronfman family, who wanted a skyscraper on Park Avenue that was standing out as a major piece of architecture. Partially, it has to be said, to do something about their reputation, because they had been known as bootleggers. They had made a fortune shipping alcohol from Canada into the United States illegally. They had had some connections to organized crime, it seems. And so for them, the chance of having a gleaming new building on Park Avenue that was recognized as a masterpiece of architecture and a contribution to architectural culture in New York, in the United States, in the world, was a major success. And they celebrated that with lots of publicity and enormous funds to make the building known and photograph well. And so that became really a monument. But I don't think it was necessarily what Mies had intended, because he would then later take the formal language of that building and replicate it in many cities around North America.
And this replication is seen in Toronto, in Chicago, of course, New York. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how his transfer from Berlin to the United States, how did his architecture change? What aspects remained the same?
What comes with the move to the United States is an enormous change in scale. He gets commissioned to design a whole campus for his new school where he teaches architecture, the Illinois Institute of Technology, and he designs the entire campus. He gets commissions for high-rises, apartment houses, and then office buildings. So it's a scale that he has never worked in before. In Germany, you know, his biggest building was a housing block in Stuttgart, and otherwise there were only residential commissions. At the same time, I see that he loses some of his love for experimentation, which is there in the early years when we see glass skyscrapers, experiments in brick and concrete, new spatial layouts. And in the United States, he finds a number of formulas for steel skeleton skyscrapers, for simple office buildings, and for big open spaces in which almost any function can be accommodated, which resulted ultimately in the National Gallery here in Berlin. And once he had sort of worked these few types out, he repeated them. And what happened, I think, is that his office, which was quite substantial in Chicago, ultimately functioned almost without his input necessary, because they knew the formulas, they knew what to do for an apartment building or an office building or a big space, and they could do it without him. Good staff that could pull these commissions through to the end with very successfully without him being there all the time.
Could you maybe talk a little bit about Mies the man? How important is that to his architecture?
It's, for me, astonishing reading all of his letters and the little communications and so on. It's astonishing to compare the clarity of his architecture. He was very good in you know, a number of instances of bringing things to a point that seems to be just the sort of most radical solution that you could find for a particular question. And then seeing how his private life was comparatively chaotic. And if you see how a masterpiece like the Barcelona Pavilion, which was that German pavilion at the World's Fair in Barcelona in 1929, how that came about. It was such a chaotic process, and Mies was apparently not a very good manager, and he was terrible with money, and things went wrong left and right. But in the end, this building emerged that became, I think, the most influential and most important structure that was built between the wars anywhere in the world.
Dietrich, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the period from the last period of his life until today, what we have today. What is the legacy of Mies in our urban situation today in Berlin and elsewhere?
When Mies starts out and designs these buildings, let's say, for American cities, let's take the Seagram Building as an example because it was such a major breakthrough. It is clearly designed in contrast to what is there surrounding it. So there are setback skyscrapers that are built, and Park Avenue is a canyon of buildings that are built right up to the edge. And he introduces a plaza and moves the building back, and it's not set back anymore, but in fact a simple geometric slab of really beautiful proportions. So he does that there, and it works to this very day enormously well as a contrast to what surrounds it. But if you now imagine this solution multiplied, and that is actually something that happened throughout New York and throughout the Western world and so on, it loses some of its strength, of course. If you imagine, just for the sake of argument, several Seagram buildings next to each other, the plaza is suddenly not interesting anymore because it's not the sort of change of pace and lighting conditions that you have now. And so he starts out with these revolutionary concepts that work in contrast to what is there before. And once he was influential enough so that others basically took his ideas and replicated them, the impact is less and less forceful, and we now live in cities that clearly show many of the results of people imitating Mies with clients that had much less money and thus were not willing to pay for very, very refined details and expensive materials. So the follow-up models by other architects are often not quite as convincing. And of course, the urban impact of his initial ideas is also sort of lost on the way. So it is a bit of a mixed blessing. What can still be learned from his work is, of course, this wonderful attention to detail, this great sense of proportions and materials and light. And in a way, these sort of essential elements of architecture are something that he was very good at handling. And that, of course, is still there. But urbanistically, it is a different picture.
Dietrich Neumann of Brown University, the author of a forthcoming biography of Mies van der Rohe, and a fellow this semester here at the American Academy in Berlin. This is the Berlin Journal.
I'm Christopher O'Reilly, host of NPR's From the Top. NPR's rigorous approach to news programming helps us all to cope with the challenges facing us as a nation. But you know what also helps America face the day? Good news. Like the story about that entrepreneur who's invented something brilliant. That story about a visionary urban nonprofit. That story about a brilliant 14-year-old pianist. Good news and hope. This is NPR.
Welcome back to the Berlin Journal. I'm RJ McGill. Hitler's atomic bomb should have materialized. Nazi Germany was a technologically developed state. Its scientists and engineers were among the world's best. Nuclear fission had been discovered in Berlin in 1938. The German army was the first to militarize nuclear energy research and development, and early German and American feasibility studies of nuclear weapons were not far apart. So why did Nazi Germany's reactor and atomic bomb projects fail, while the American all-out efforts, known as the Manhattan Project, yielded a successful atomic weapon? These questions form the core of the project currently underway by Wolf Schaefer, a historian of science and the Associate Dean of International Academic Programs at Stony Brook University. As a fellow this semester here at the American Academy in Berlin, Schaefer's project explores the functional and dysfunctional management factors likely to make or break large-scale R&D programs. Wolf Schaefer and I sat down in the American Academy's library to talk about what he's uncovered.
With the beginning of the war, 1st of September 1939, the so-called Army Ordnance Office, Heereswaffenamt, took over all the research about this possibility. And that taking over took the form of taking over the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics. They were purely research institutes. That is, no need to teach, and all the money you need. The practical meaning is that the director of the institute loses its power, and that the researchers at the institute now report practically to the army. Mm-hmm. And that was the case. And that case came into effect less than 12 months after the discovery of fission. So what happened at the same time in the United States is not the same. The news about fission spread in January to the United States.
I was just going to ask that. What would have been the organs that transferred that information?
The organ was actually a person that was Niels Bohr.
Uh-huh.
Niels Bohr was traveling by steamship to the U.S., giving talks at Columbia and other places, And he was talking in, he's giving his talk early in January, I think, and it is reported that before he has finished, physicists are running out of the lecture, going to their laboratories and starting to kind of replicate. I mean, this, everybody who could know knew immediately, this is big, very, very big. And so it starts now in the US. All the research that was also done in Germany was also done in the US. So the equivalent nuclear physicists and chemists worked on the same questions and came pretty much within the next 2 years to the same conclusions. Theoretically, it's clear. It can be done. It's just an engineering and so on problem. So the two countries do all the necessary to figure out what is now needed. And in the United States, it's done by universities. Not that the government is not alerted, but they have not put it under army leadership. So, and it is one of those ironic moments when Germany finally decides that this is too complicated for the ongoing war effort, the United States decides this can be done and we are going to do it. When Germany officially pulls back, the United States officially pulls in. And that's where then Leslie Groves and the Manhattan Project and all that happens. So for 2 years, both to the basic research, the most important conclusion actually is the conclusion that there is another element that can be used. So that plutonium discovery is made in the United States and is made in Germany by Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker. So what then is noted, and for instance, Heisenberg says that at this moment we saw that there's an open road to a bomb. But then the paths, they go in different directions for reasons that are complicated. In Germany, the interest wanes, but in the United States, the interest rises. The Manhattan Project is created. Leslie Groves takes over. Oppenheimer is chosen to run it on the scientific side and so on and so forth. We know that story. And in Germany, the you could say the air goes out of that project. Now, why did that happen? Several things. One is, the Army Ordnance Office was getting under pressure coming down from Hitler, and that pressure was mounting in 1942. Until then, Germany had done these Blitzkriege, and the Blitzkriege were also successful. And then Hitler, in his wisdom, had decided he does another Blitzkrieg, and then he is finished, namely the Blitzkrieg against Russland. So he attacks the Soviet Union, which he had neutralized before with the non-aggression pact. But then out of the blue, he attacks the Soviet Union, was not prepared for that, didn't believe it. They were sure or not sure. They could see that might come in the future, but it not when it came. That campaign, which should have been over again, like Blitzkrieg, very quickly, did not end, and the German army got stuck in the winter before Moscow. And all of a sudden, the Blitzkrieg, that's normally over in a few weeks or months, was looking like a real war. And the German economy was not prepared for a long war. So they, from that moment on, they had to improvise. And what that meant was that now came down from the Führer, the order, and everybody had to follow, that only things that can be done in less than a year, half a year, or maximum 9 months or so, could be undertaken. And everything that was not of real immediate effect for the war effort was forbidden. And so the Heereswaffenamt, which was, I mean, these were run by artillery people and so on, they could understand that, and they then said, we want to keep it going, but we want to keep it going in a way, the only way that is appropriate for now, and that is basically the way of basic research.
And was it something that was comparably expensive for the government to pay for?
It is hugely expensive.
Okay.
And if it's then, and of course everybody knows, if it works, everything will be forgiven.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, heads will roll. That was what all those knowledgeable involved realized Germany would not be able to launch in the war, in the ongoing war, at that moment when the war was getting ever more badly. However, at the very same time, there was one project going on in the Third Reich that was equivalent in a way. Not exactly the same, but very close in terms of expenditure of wealth of the country. And that was the rocket program. The people involved, and these are especially two, Wernher von Braun, that everybody knows, and then Dornberger, a general who was overseeing that program. They were friends and they were working together. And when in 42, when Albert Speer takes over all the armament management of the Reich, they managed to convince Speer that the rocket program is absolutely important. And so the uncountable millions of Reichsmark that are spent on the Peenemünde rocket program are de facto very equivalent what in the end the United States spent for the Manhattan Project, Germany spent for the rocket program. They did the rocket program, and what did they do? They did it the German way of the Third Reich, namely underground. They built complete underground facilities. So you have to think of a whole factory with thousands of workers underground, and the workers, concentration camp people. So this is when the only workers that Germany has in abundance are Russians, Poles, Jewish people in the concentration camps. They have to ask Himmler to help them out and give them the numbers of people. Mm-hmm. And Himmler is very happy to do that. From Bergen-Belsen, from everywhere, even from Auschwitz later on, when the thousands. Only very recently do we know better what actually happened in these underground factories. I mean, Dante's hell is just a fairy tale against that. It's unbelievable. If you look at it very cold-blooded, you could say, if Hitler, in this case, had decided, I want to build the bomb and not the rocket, the same would have happened. Sure. It would have happened underground. It would have happened with concentration camp labor, and the money that spent there would have worked. In Germany, you have a comparatively democratic checks and balances. I mean that ironically, situation where what we call often has been called polycracy. There are so many. There's one Führer, but there are hundreds of little Führers, and every little Führer competes with another little Führer. So what the operational principle of Hitler was, not give power to one person only. Have always at least two people, because then they compete, two little Führers, and nobody will compete with him, they will compete with themselves. And that was the situation in Germany. So if in Germany ever one and one would have been added, put the nuclear effort together with the rocket effort, which happened then after the war immediately, right? And in the context of sending these V2s over to London, you could have smaller ones, more of them,
nuclear
ballistic missiles. That's what it was, right? And so that connection was never made. And it's good that it was never made. But it shows you how anarchic and erratic this whole effort was.
Wolf Schaefer of Stony Brook University speaking with the Berlin Journal.
So, yes, my name is Reinhold Kegel. I am the chef at the American Academy in Berlin.
Reinhold Kegel has been in charge of the kitchen and cuisine here at the American Academy since it opened in 1998. Before that, he trained and studied in Germany, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Italy. Eventually, after stints in Berlin at the restaurants Paris Moscow and Le Grand Cru, he settled at a Michelin-starred restaurant with plenty of admirers. He was discovered there by the Academy's leadership and promptly recruited.
So, and then the first Thanksgiving comes. And it was like, you know, we're celebrating Thanksgiving here. do you know about Thanksgiving? And I said, okay, yeah, Thanksgiving, I heard about that, but is there something special? Oh, yes, you know, the turkey, the pumpkins and everything. And I was, okay, let's read about it a little bit. And I said, okay, there is something similar, what we call in Germany, Erntedankfest. And I remembered we celebrated that in my childhood in the kindergarten. And we brought all the corn, the wheat, and fruits, and apples, and pears, and certain grapes. That was not the big feast what you have, with the turkey, getting the family together. And then I said, okay, yeah, what is it about? I mean, the harvest, what you've had over the year. And I said, okay, yeah, let's do something with that.
At the Academy, Reinhold has cooked for presidents, secretaries of state, chancellors, foreign ministers, and celebrities of every stripe, and, of course, for our fellows and distinguished visitors. His cuisine has become legendary. That first November, when a number of fellows approached him with their concerns about what would be offered at the holiday feast, he learned firsthand about the singular importance Americans attach to the Thanksgiving meal. Writing in 2003 in The New Yorker on the care and maintenance of Americans living abroad on Thanksgiving, journalist Jane Kramer, who was once an Academy Fellow, singles out our chef in these words. Reinhold Kegel read up on the big feast and, inspired by the idea and perhaps the availability of pumpkins, produced a Thanksgiving dinner that, barring the turkey, was almost entirely orange. Pumpkin soup, pumpkin puree, and pumpkin pie.
She was a little bit nervous about Thanksgiving because, we are in Germany and... do you have everything, the turkey, the cranberries, and so on? And she was a little bit, I wouldn't say afraid, but a little bit nervous about this. So, and then the evening came, and she went into the dining room, and she said, oh, nice, you have all these things. And then she said, oh, it's all orange. And I said, of course it's all orange. Yeah, why that? And I said, okay, it's not all orange. You have the green beans and so on. Yeah, but mostly it's orange. Why did you do that? And I said, okay, come on. A sweet potato, a pumpkin, a cranberry is red. The turkey is brown and red. I mean, we are in late autumn. Look out of the window. Think about a sunset. What is it, orange? Look into the nature. What is it, orange? There is nothing green. And she said, I understand. No?
Reinhold Kegel, the executive chef here at the American Academy in Berlin and the man responsible for the turkey and trimmings on the Thanksgiving table. And that's it for this edition of the Berlin Journal, a production of the American Academy in Berlin, NPR Berlin, and NPR Worldwide. For more on the American Academy in Berlin, you can visit our website, americanacademy.de, and for more on NPR Berlin, please visit our website, nprberlin.de. Our production team includes Jeff Rosenberg in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. I'm your host, RJ McGill.